the weird thing is, all these people are like, oh, we've got to have male characters, and they've got to be, they've always been male, and everything. And you're thinking, you fashy little shits. The thing is, you think you're so fucking, you're so into like that, and oh, capitalism and everything. And it's like, they don't realize, like, capitalism ultimately goes, you know what will sell more stuff? Broadening the demographic.
So, I'm trying to think, Sean, what have I been doing? I played Warcry yesterday. That was fun.
Is it worth still playing Warcry?
Yes. Yes, it is. Warcry's brilliant because...
I love Warcry so
it's
much.
It's brilliant. So, the boss for most of my time while I was at Sheffield, when I was working at Sheffield University... So he's now basically, it's great. He's now, no, because he's not my boss. He's only a few years older than me. So it's like, now we're just gaming buddies. So it's like, it's fine. So
cool.
It's always nice. So he was using the, is it the Wilder Corps? The new.
Oh, the ones with the doggies.
With the doggies. Yeah. And we're playing the scenario. This fucking scenario was like, we randomized it. And the scenario was, you've got to take control of the objectives. There are three of them. And at the end of the turn, if you control it, you get either D3 on two of them, or it's D6 VPs. So it's random VPs, and you have to get at the end of turn four, if you're that player doing that, which I was, you have to get a total of 16 victory points. But if they control any, they remove D3 victory points from you. And this fucking warband, this fucking warband of dogs outnumbered me so much. And I was using the Scourge of Vampires, and I just could not kill enough fast enough to rack up VPs, which just shows how Warcry is. It's like, you can't...
I was playing a game against my son, because I've got a son who's old enough to do that, and I was playing the Unmade versus Stormcast Eternals.
Yeah.
And... the Unmade, if you know anything about them, are like, he was Stormcast Eternals, I was the Unmade, and the Unmade, in a straight up fight, the Stormcast just sort of stand there and the little knives go donk, and just bounce off. But the particular scenario that we pulled from the deck of cards was the one where you basically just have to get a certain number of your warband off the side of the table before
I've
the other side get you.
I played that a few weeks ago, almost a month ago.
When you're against Stormcasts, they're just like lumbering around, and we're like, they're going, no, we're not fighting you, we're just running away.
It was, I had exactly the same setup. It was, my opponent was using Stormcast, and literally there were just five of them.
Four.
You had to get, like, what? Maybe you had to get... I can't remember how many you had to get off, like, a third of your force or something
You had to get a big chunk of the warband off. But, yeah, I mean, I just basically sacrificed the hardest guys I had to tie them up for a couple of rounds.
And I was using Cypher Lords. So they literally ninjaed across the board.
Yeah.
And at one point, I was just like... I was, because my opponent was new to Warcry, so it was like, I was watching them, I was trying to, like, not, like, go hard on it so they could learn the rules, because I knew I could just, like, run and be done with it. But it was great because you could see after, like, literally the first turn, my opponent, you could see how the rules just clicked, and it was like, oh, this game is simple rules, but, like, tactically deep, which
it
is brilliant.
It is. Is there going to be a third edition, do you think?
I think there will be. But yeah, with my Cypher Lords, it just got to the point I was like, right, I was done with playing nice and like being like not using my warband to its full potential. And I was like, I'll now show you what's possible. And did the full teleportation shenanigans that the Cypher Lords can do, where you're just like, they're now 12 inches over here. This one's flying. And it was like, yeah, the game over. But I think that's the point, isn't it? It's because when you look at the cards and you go, oh yeah, on paper, Stormcast look amazing, or that warband has tons of, is freaking huge. But that all becomes academic based upon the scenario and the twist.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's beautiful. I like it a lot more than Age of Sigmar.
Yeah, yeah.
Although obviously Age of Sigmar is going to be a completely different game in a couple months.
It's looking, I mean, I've been liking the previews. I'm liking how they're trying to go, like, make it very clear what special abilities work in which phase. So that's all very, like, so they're trying to structure things so you don't have to, like, flip through your book as much, I think. That's what they're going for.
They've also done something about the double turn. I don't know if they've done enough about the double turn, but they've done something about the double turn.
What have they done about double turn?
Now you can choose not to take a double turn, because a double turn will cost you command points.
And you command points command are rarer points, now. And
they're rarer. And a double turn will cost you your command points. So you get your double turn, you will do actually quite a bit less. I think, you know what, everybody's like there going, that's not going to count for anything. But you know what, I reckon that's like a war cry level of deep that kind of might actually be.
Yeah, like, because in war cry, it's like you're always going like, oh, I've won the initiative. But you're there with your wild eye and like going, do I want to keep it? Or do I let my opponent take it so I can promote and get a further double or get a triple out of something? And
I mean, yeah. Yeah, I mean, but my Sigmar armies, however, I'm okay for
Sigmar
cash.
Army's gone.
Well, you can say that because I've basically got three Age of Sigmar armies that I can kind of like make a soup army with. They happen to be a Slaanesh army, okay, mm-hmm. a Slaves of Darkness army where a lot of the battle line was five Warcry warbands.
Same.
And the third one, a slightly smaller Beasts of Chaos force.
Oh, well, they're fucking hell. So you've got a Slaanesh army then?
So I've got, well, to be fair, I've got a Slaanesh army. I do still have Chaos Warriors, Chaos Knights. I've got some Varan Guards. But I can't use my Giants anymore. I can't use my Saigor. I've got some Chaos Gargants, Saigor. You know,
oh, they're all chaos. They're all
beasts of chaos.
I'm sure they'll address that because
I'm not sure they will. They're moving them all to, because you've got to bear in mind that the Chaos Gargant is the same kit as the Man Crusher Gargant, and that was originally an old World Warhammer kit anyway.
Oh no, I was thinking of the bigger Gargants that you get the new plastic ones for.
Oh no, they're Sons of Behemoth.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So then, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. No, the plastic, but the original Chaos Gargant was part of the Warhammer Giant kit.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is an excellent kit. It's like, it's basically a bucket of bits.
Yeah.
It's got so much stuff in it. I've used bits of it all over the place, like the birds as well. You've got birds. You've got peasants running away. You've got a random cow. All that stuff. I don't know if you saw, I built a house out of plasticard and various things because I got a door. Tons of bits from the Gargant on that. Going back to games though, the thing that I've been following recently is the development of Trench Crusade.
I haven't got into reading the rules yet for that.
I've been looking at a lot of the lore and a lot of the warbands and like trying to work out what I've got that I can sort of put in. I've got a bunch of Bestiarum models that you can probably put into a warband. I've also, there's a game called Planet 28, which is made by one of those little boutique companies that have their foundations on Instagram, called Mammoth Miniatures.
Okay.
And I picked up a copy of Planet 28, and it's essentially Inquisitor if Inquisitor was playable.
yeah.
And for 28 mil figures.
Right. Oh, okay, cool. Oh, yeah, I might have to get hold of a copy of that then.
But yeah, it's a little hardback book. It's only 15 quid a pop, and you can get it from Mammoth Miniatures, so you can probably Google that. I was actually thinking of just doubling the measurements and using my various converted Inquisitor figures to do Planet 54. Well, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because that just seems like fun. So you asked me to come on your podcast to talk about this.
we're just talking about gaming in general.
Yeah, we're having a preamble ramble as another gaming podcast. Yeah,
I mean, part of the reason was because, like, you know, after we did the Imperial Horror episode, and it's
someone told us we were going to hell.
Yeah, someone told us we were going to hell. We are.
Spoilers, we are. Yeah.
And, like, after that and everything, like, I've had COVID since then and work has been so busy, mate. And stuff. And obviously, it was like, now I'm vaccinated, so I'm back into doing some gaming, and Sam's going to get vaccinated at some point soon.
Good.
So I'm back into doing some in-person gaming again, because, like, after you get COVID, that was the first time I've had COVID. I was just like, no, never again. But yeah, it's... I thought it was just good to talk about your gaming, because, like, you, like I said, you do the kind of Grimdark stuff. You've got your Inquisitor models, and I think you mostly have a, like, opinions approach to, like, what you enjoy in gaming, what you think's cool and
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, people
Whereas
know...
Whereas I just mourn the fact that my Sacrosanct army is now not going to be supported, because thanks, GW. My entire
In fact, also, my son has a Age of Sigmar army, which is entirely Sacrosanct Chamber Stormcasts.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's no longer... He's not bothered.
No,
really.
No. I mean, I don't play tournaments, like, so who cares?
But yeah, like, actually, one more thing in terms of gaming is that, and this is quite rare, actually. It used to happen a lot. It used to happen like every month for a few years, but a game product has come out with my name on it.
Oh, yes.
And also the quick start for it came out with my name on it.
Oh, that's the Cthulhu
Awakens.
Yeah, which is
Green Ronin.
Is that using the Modern Age rule set?
Yes, it's using a version of the Modern Age EE rule set. Modern Age. We're gonna go broke, obviously, because we've gone woke. But
obviously.
But which I think is a lot of what we're going to be talking about, actually, as well, going broke and woke. But it's essentially it's about taking a look at the history of the last century in the view of the Cthulhu mythos, but giving it a revisionist lens.
Yeah.
Essentially, treating it like real life history, using the tools that modern historians would use.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And basically creating a history that does actually look at what, you know, poor people and black people and gay people were doing, and how mythos stuff would have affected them. This has already had people be mean.
Of course.
Of course it has. The quick start, I was very, very, like... I was asked if I would write an English folk horror quick start set in World War II.
Nice. Oh, I need to get this quick start. I need to bug the guys at Green Ronin if they might bum me a copy so we can use it for the podcast.
And the folk horror thing I used was Bella in the Witch Elm, which is a particular piece of dark British folklore from the 1940s.
Right.
Which is pretty good. It's what happens in a town called Hagley in Worcestershire in the Black Country.
Oh god, that's a bit close to home for me.
In 1943, a group of boys who were playing hooky from school found a woman's corpse upside down in a tree trunk.
Weird.
And no one ever worked out who she was. And there are conspiracy theories about that. And no one knew who the woman was. But within about a year afterwards, graffiti started appearing around the Black Country on walls reading, "Who put Bella in the Witch Elm? Who put Bella in the Witch Elm?" And
cool. Oh, well, not cool for her. So cool,
there's a fantastic documentary called Bella in the Witch Elm, which is made by a very nice guy called Tom Lee Rutter, which you can find online. I uh, I'm particularly fond of it because it's got a quote from my book on the back of the Blu-ray, which is kind of cool. But, you know, it's like, hey, I did the blurb for it. But no, that's the only thing I contributed, honestly. It's a fantastic piece of work. It's basically the British Wisconsin death trip, right, if that means anything to you.
Oh, wow. I can't wait to get hold of that because, I mean, I'm eager to do, like, I need to, I'm racking my brains at some point because obviously we're doing for the podcast of our, like, deep dives on games. So we're doing, we just recorded the first episode of Old Gods of Apalachia. And that's...
oh, right.
Again, it's Eldritch horror meets, you know, Appalachian, like, mythology lore. And it's 1920s, 1930s period. So, yeah, you're examining the impact of, like, industrialization on these communities in the... in what is effectively the wilderness there. So it's... And one of the key things with that podcast is that, and how the book is written is, again, like actually looking at what life was like for, you know, people of color, the actual natives there,
yeah,
all the different people that have immigrated there. And then, so we're doing that. So we're doing character creation in a couple of weeks' time, and then we'll be doing an actual play of it. So I think it's interesting that that's out. And then obviously the approach to Cthulhu, Awakens, to have that kind of modern kind of historian approach to looking at the time period and how people really were, and then reflecting that back into how you represent, you know, horror, whether it's through the lens of love, well, what we call Lovecraftian mythos or similar.
Yeah,
cool.
So I mean, you know, it's really interesting as well, because obviously I don't think a lot of people realise how much of the Cthulhu mythos lore as we know it is actually owned by Chaosium.
Yeah, yeah.
That actually a whole bunch of it is actually original to Chaosium.
Mm-hmm.
So in a lot of ways, we've basically had to go back to, and I say we, the leading light for this was Malcolm Shepherd.
Yeah.
We basically had to go back to the point where we're looking at the Lovecraft stories and the associated stories that are out of copyright.
Yeah.
Which amounts to Lovecraft, Chambers is King in Yellow stories, Robert E. Yeah. Howard stories. Yeah, you know, those.
Mm-hmm.
And a few others, basically out of copyright stuff, but also there's a lot of stuff in Call of Cthulhu that is essentially an interpretation and an extrapolation of things in original Lovecraft rather than the actual Lovecraft. And so we've had to go back and do things. So, for example, in the Lovecraft story, The Festival, the monster, there's two monsters in The Festival. One is something that's not a bird and not an insect and not a gorilla, but something that's kind of not quite any of those things. In Call of Cthulhu, that's called a Biarchy.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And that's really a Chaosium invention via later authors. Likewise, the other monster in The Festival is essentially the cultists who all happen to be basically made from worms.
Right.
Sentient wizards made of worms. And in Call of Cthulhu, that's called a crawling one.
Right.
And in Cthulhu Awakens, we basically had to go right back to the story and work out what it would be if Call of Cthulhu hadn't existed. And so
wow.
I believe Malcolm called it Gregarian. But yeah. Yeah,
that's a lot of work. That's a lot of work, and so much of what what we think of like Cthulhu mythos has been like defined by the RPG. I mean, it's a bit like Star Wars. Like without Star Wars roleplay, extended universe would be not really much.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it's really interesting how that happened. I mean, I'm kind of guilty of some of that. I've got one of my more dubious RPG industry claims to fame is that I've got two entries in the Cthulhu Mythos Encyclopedia.
Oh wow!
because I wrote for I wrote for some of the officially accepted fanzines, including the Black Seal, but also in Worlds of Cthulhu, which was the licensed thing that Pegasus Spieler did. I wrote the only adventure that features the great old one Saiga, who's the big eye surrounded by tentacles, who's in the rule book but never used. And I went back to the story and wrote that adventure. It was called Sufficient Unto Today. But that, so yeah, I've written a few things many years ago now. It's like I've got, you know, my role playing stuff. Some of my role playing stuff goes about 20 years now.
Yeah, it will do now. Yeah. I was thinking about that. Like Requiem came out 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but your point being is Cthulhu Awakens is out and is like, so you're already getting, you've already got people going, oh, it's woke and so forth about it. And obviously,
it is literally called Cthulhu Awakens. They knew what they were doing.
Yeah, right. And it's just like, it's so tiresome because, like, obviously, it's tiring because, like, dealing with that, because first of all, I don't even know what, when everything that someone doesn't like is now apparently woke. Like, the term has zero meaning. It's
or if
bizarre.
Your Liz Truss is the deep state.
Oh, it's the deep state, yeah. And and obviously, you know, with wargaming right now, because apparently in the new codex for Adeptus Custodes, there's a character, literally a small snippet of fluff, which has a character, a custodie, with female pronouns, and that is
there's a girl custodies
uproar and people flipping
uproar.
Out. And the fact is, like, it's like, but they never said custodies were all male. And does it?
I mean, I mean, they just only made male
does
models.
It fucking matter?
But also, as I understand it, this isn't even the first time that fiction in lore has portrayed a female custodies.
I think there's been a few.
I think there was one a couple of years ago. It's just no one noticed that one.
Yeah.
And more importantly, Games Workshop didn't go, oh, there've been female custodies since the beginning on Twitter.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
possibly is actually the thing that caused the problem rather than there being.
But it's such fucking nonsense because does it impact rolling your dice and moving your plastic war dollies round on the board? No. And this revisionist thing, right? Even if it is revisionist, right? Like we've done it with Iron Kingdoms. You know the what are they called? Satisix? They originally for the Crix faction, they were the lady pirate raiders for the Crixian force who had big horns, right? And originally it was, all the males are just die out because of whatever blight causes them to be pathetic and everything and just, you know, die very quickly. In the new edition of the RPG, you know, we were just like, yeah, fuck that. You know, we're not just going to have all these classes. No, it doesn't matter. If it ever used to be female only or male only, we've just gone, nah. And you know why? Because the weird thing is, all these people are like, oh, we're going to have male characters and they've always been male and everything. And you're thinking, you fashy little shits. The thing is, you think you're so into like that and, oh, capitalism and everything. And it's like, they don't realize, like, capitalism ultimately goes, you know what, we'll sell more stuff, broadening the demographic, which ultimately means making stuff that more people want to buy to get more people to
want to buy. Have you seen the new Chaos Brooders?
Yeah,
half of them are girls.
Exactly.
No one's actually, they're not making any kind of deal about that. It's just half of them are girls. And they've sort of been doing that largely when they've been re-upping and refreshing their forces.
Age of Sigmar obviously gets a free pass all the time, but it's because it's a brand new setting. Somehow 40K is like the canon is written on vellum and must never be touched. Yeah,
which is weird because
so many fucking times.
Yeah, because it's weird that the canon like, none of these people would recognize the canon from, because I'm old enough to have a copy, to have got a copy of Rogue Trader when Rogue Trader came out, right? And let me tell you, there's female Space Marines in that book.
Yeah.
Like, the Adeptus Sororitas are female Space Marines in Rogue Trader.
Yeah.
Because this is before Sisters of Battle was sort of produced.
Exactly,
thing.
Yeah.
And there were even a couple of female Space Marine models, which, of course, everybody knows, which there are only a couple, but they did have the same insignia as the female Space Marine illustration in Rogue Trader, Sister Sin. Yeah. This is not a devil's advocate thing.
Okay.
This is not a devil's advocate thing, because you're right, they're flashy little jerks, okay?
Yeah.
That doesn't stop it. Games Workshop do not communicate this very well.
No, they do not do this well. Of course.
So in the same way that they really, really, really fudged the announcement of the vast numbers of fantasy models that were going to be retired, including three entire armies, right?
Yeah.
Right. Well, one army of Stormcast, one army of Orcs, and all of the Beasts of Chaos army, with all the monsters and stuff. They fudged that announcement quite badly. They didn't say what they were going to do with all the Warcry War. You know, they fudged it, you know? And it's easy to say, well, you know, you don't have to go to tournaments. You just play with your friends. They're going to have profiles for them in the next couple of years. You could still play third edition if you want, you know? You can still play second edition if you want. You know, that's fine, but that's not the point, is it? That's not how it feels. And likewise, it's like, yeah, all right, female custodians is cool. There were already a... It was weird, because there's obviously a segregated sub-faction of the custodians, the Sisters of Silence.
Yeah.
They're part of the custodians army. As I understand it, they're kind of a retcon as well. They were a sort
change
of the law, because they were originally a heresy army that people liked so much they wanted to play in 40k. I bought a pack of Sisters of Silence and turned them into Chaos Warriors, because that's the kind of person, fantasy Chaos Warriors, because that's the kind of person I am. But, you know, I did some heavy converting on them. But, yeah, I mean, they exist as a weird kind of retcon. I think one of the things about the custodians is that as a faction in 40k, and incidentally a sub-faction that has also existed since Rogue Trader, except in Rogue Trader they just didn't have shirts.
Yeah.
You know, I had the original custodians model long ago. He doesn't
have
a shirt.
Power armor.
Yeah, he doesn't have power armor. He's like wearing trousers, a shirt. He's got a very pointy helmet, and he's got a bolt gun on a end of a very long lance.
Yeah.
The original custodians model is like you would not recognize it. Now,
I mean,
they're
are we going
like,
to complain that we don't have Zotes in Tyranid armies?
Like they brought a Zote back for Blackstone Fortress.
It's a great model. Yeah, I've got it.
Yeah, they only had it out for about 9 months.
Yeah.
Disappeared. I didn't manage to get it in time because I wanted that Zote. But it's like the custodians as a faction don't make a lot of sense. In order to expand them, they retconned in one of the other female force from Horus Heresy. They kind of did that. I think that's actually making the point that it's even stupider to get uptight about changing the law, because their law's never made sense. It's never been much good. And
exactly.
Like, they're not a faction. I don't even know why they even exist, because there's no differentiation between the models. They're just all the same, you know.
I mean, this is the thing with the role playing game, because I can actually say, like, you know, because just today, or was it yesterday? Yesterday, the Vow of Absolution book for Wrath and Glory came out, which is the Space Marine. It's basically the Space Marine players book for Wrath and Glory, but it also primarily looks at the Absolvers, and a lot of the comments are like, well, why is it only the Absolvers? Why haven't you got lots of detailed information about the other Space Marine chapters? It's like, well, first of all, that'd be a fucking huge book and no one would buy it, because it would be so expensive. And all that material is already out there. And also, you know, there's kind of like a there's a practical approach to this, pragmatic approach. There's what, and there's also, you know, there's what we can do as writers, and also there's what, you know, Games Workshop lets Cubicle 7 do. Like, the reason why everything's Gilead really is, it's our playground where we can do what we want without fucking around and contradicting other published material out there. You know, it's the whole thing with, like, why, you know, if you look at why, well, anything like licensed IP, you know, Games Workshop, you know, licensed IP and is very protective of it because, you know, some things you just can't cover or you can't include. Other things, they want it to synchronize well. It's just because they want to control their IP. So you do what you're told. And, you know, and sometimes that means while writing something, you find out something's been revised by another release that's in the main line. And you have to, like, do some work to update
bring it
so
back into line, yeah. Like, which, just, I mean, it's not something that anything. Used to happen. It's not something that used to happen. I mean, back in, like, you know, the 70s and even the 80s, you would have stuff based on existing IPs, like comic books based. The original Marvel Star Wars comic books include a major character who's a green bunny.
So this isn't Bucky O'Hare, is it?
No, this predates Bucky O'Hare. They include a major character who's a bunny in space, right. In a spacesuit, and a whole bunch of stuff. There's the Doctor Who comics the Marvel UK Doctor Who comics include, like, the 1980s Marvel UK comics include as the Doctor's longest running, the Sixth Doctor's longest running companion. Because there's many more Sixth Doctor comic strip stories than there are actual televised stories, because the Sixth Doctor era ran for a long time because the show kept getting cancelled and uncancelled. Mm-hmm. But of course, the magazine carries on for 4 years. And so his main companion is Frobisher, who is a Whiffadil, a shape-shifting alien, whose preferred form is a penguin. So he spends... Wow. The Sixth Doctor's main companion is a talking penguin.
That's like talking. See, that's woke. Talking penguins are woke.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Gay talking penguins are woke.
yes.
But yeah, I mean, what was I going to say? I think.
But it's.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the problem is... Oh, I know what I was going to say. On the flip side also, one of my partners has been in a huge argument on Facebook. Well, not a huge argument, but quite a big argument, because somebody on Facebook has been saying you shouldn't play Warhammer 40K because it has a lot of Nazis that play it.
Right.
And this just proves it. And, you know, them getting angry about girls being in one of their favourite space Nazi factions just proves it. And that's also completely wrong, because in the end, this is just a hobby.
Yeah.
Okay. And on the one hand, there isn't such a thing as just a hobby, because it is something that brings you joy. It's something that you can develop a sense of community with and make friendships out of. It's something that you can do stuff. But let's be honest, it is a hobby predicated on consuming a product.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you buy stuff in order to paint it and play with it.
Yeah.
Right, that is not the same as being in a religious or political community. It is not the same as being in an oppressed group. It's not the same as being a follower of a political party or having an ideology. Right, like if my political party had Nazis in it, I wouldn't want to be in the political party if they weren't doing something to kick those people out.
Yeah,
but if Nazis are buying the same plastic toys that I am, that's different.
Like I'm not about to put in the bin my Sisters of Battle army because James Cleverly collects Sisters of Battle.
Right, yes.
Because
exactly.
He does. I think it was on a Newsnight.
He had his Sisters of Battle codex and some miniatures on the shelf behind him.
That's brilliant.
A lot of things slipped in lockdown, didn't they? Let's be honest. A lot of things slipped over lockdown. It's like, I mean, I'm not going to give up. I mean, actually, Nazis don't play Slaanesh, so it doesn't matter. But so no. I'm going to keep my army. But like, yeah, it's just
the problem. Like you say, the problem is that people attach. I mean, this is actually it's interesting because I was talking about this to my boss about how it's about what you feel defines you as a person, and I was talking to my boss about how, like, having left academia, I then see on like LinkedIn, I see people who I've worked with or who I know of from at university who've gone, oh, I've got my fund, got this huge amount of funding, and they're like, oh, now I can set up my research group and everything else. And it's just like, and then I think for a minute, I go, oh, fuck, I really wish I was able to get the funding. And then I think, but then I'd still be in academia.
I tried academia. It's not fun.
But the point is that for a long time, my sense of self was based around academia. Publishing. Were the papers I published and my research and being a doctor of chemistry doing that kind of stuff. Whereas now it's like, nah, that doesn't define me. My job doesn't define me. And even though I write the fucking role-play games where we literally have brought out a book which lets you play Terminators for these fucking space fascists, it's a fucking hobby and it doesn't define me. It doesn't define me. Yeah. It's what I do as my job and it's what I like as a hobby, but it does not define me as a person or my political opinions. If anything, it helps me express... It's great if you could squeeze some satire in there because that's how you express your political opinions. And I think we do try and do that in places. It's much easier when you write some Warhammer Fantasy roleplay.
yeah, but... I mean, it is. It is like that, isn't it? I like movies. I write about things. I have a very active Patreon, which I'm going to plug. It's patreon.com/room207press. I've been writing a lot recently. I don't know if you've noticed.
Dune.
I am doing a series on Dune at the moment. I'm doing Dune. I'm doing all its adaptations. I'm also going to look at the Jodaverse as well.
Nice.
I'm glad, yeah, which means you know what the Jodaverse is. That's kind of cool. But yeah, you know what the Jodaverse is, right?
It's based upon the unmade movie and therefore the designs and ideas that were going to be for that Dune film.
Yeah, Alexander Hodorovsky's Dune movie that didn't get made. He took so many liberties with the text of Dune in his script. So many liberties. It's basically there's sandworms in a desert planet and some Fremen and some of the characters have the same names, but that's like, about as far as it
that
goes.
That reminds me, because like, but, isn't like the whole concept of like what do you call it? Stages of navigators is entirely from Dune. That's though entirely from Lynch's film.
Well, you see, that's interesting. The third stage navigator. Because Frank Herbert's last book came out after David Lynch's movie.
Yeah.
Some of the changes to the mythos that David Lynch introduced are reintroduced in the final one of Frank Herbert's Dune books. So, for example, navigators...
So it's gone woke. It's gone woke.
Something like that. But like navigators in Frank Herbert, in Frank Herbert's Dune, navigators use spice to travel through space.
Yeah.
Because spice allows them to see the future.
Yeah.
And if they can see the future, they can dodge
gravitational anomalies.
Yeah. They can dodge rocks and black holes. In David Lynch's film, the navigators fold space.
Yeah.
They use their immense psychic powers to take to basically fold space in an atomic way so that two points become the same place and just zap there. And Frank Herbert clearly thought, fuck, why didn't I think of that?
Yeah.
And that puts it in. And likewise, the third stage navigator that it appears in Chapter House Dune is the one from David Lynch's movie.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. But no, David Lynch, Dune actually is great. The Jodaverse is Hodorovsky's comics. Basically, he uses all the stuff that he added to Dune to make his own comic universe. And it's...
Right, on the character designs and original artwork, it's very Oh, I can't think of his name, from Marvel artist who like basically designed fucking everything.
Jack Kirby?
Yes.
It's largely that, but also Hodorowsky met Mebius while working on his version of Dune, as well as H.R. Right. Giger, Hans yes. Giger. But he met Mebius, and Mebius he then worked with on his comics.
Right.
So that's why the Incal looks like Hodorowsky's Dune.
Right.
The fact that it's going to be an Incal movie directed by Taika Waititi, or there was going to be, is another interesting thing that I'm kind of keeping half an eye on. But Dune is interesting because Warhammer 40K is the illicit love child of a regrettable liaison between Michael Moorcock's Eternal Champion series and Dune.
Yeah.
And Frank Herbert's Dune.
Yeah.
Moorcock's Eternal Champion series basically gives you the whole law and chaos and mutations thing, right? Chaos gods and all that sort of thing. Michael Moorcock, fantastic, who, as one YouTube drama channel described him, a man so respected in the science fiction field that no one takes the piss out of his name.
Yeah.
But I love a bit of Moorcock. I really do love Moorcock's yeah. stuff so much. He's my actually probably one of my favourite authors. Herbert is not one of my favourite authors, but he's a really interesting author. Mm. Not least because he's got freaking weird politics.
Mm-hmm.
I was a libertarian.
Yeah.
He wrote another series of books about a guy called George X. McKee, who was a functionary of a future space utopian government. Except okay. he's a member of the Bureau of Sabotage, and his job right. is specifically to stop the wider government that he works for working efficiently.
Right.
Because an efficiently working government is tyranny.
Interesting.
He's basically Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec played straight in space.
Right.
And that's one of Frank Herbert's series. I think the Whipping Star and Dasadi Experiment. But yeah, so Frank Herbert's Dune. So you've got the God Emperor. You've got the Immortal God Emperor. Except in Frank Herbert's Dune, the actual God Emperor, who appears at the end of the third book and is the main character in the fourth book, is a immortal 3,500-year-old human sandworm hybrids.
Yeah.
But he's got an Imperial Guard of invincible warriors who mm-hmm. are all women.
Hmm.
They're all women. For the least woke reasons you could possibly imagine. Namely, male armies wind up being gay. I mean, the weird thing is, God Emperor Dune, which is the one with the human sandworm hybrid, is actually, of all the six books, the best written.
Hmm.
Even better, it's actually a better book than the first book.
Wow.
But it's also a sequel, so it can't exist on its own.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can't understand a word of it unless you've actually read the three previous books, right? But it's a better written book than actually his first book. I mean, the last two, the plot synopses can basically amount to a post-it note of Frank Herbert's fridge saying, "Tuesday, write another Dune book." But
it's really interesting. Like, if you obviously are chronically online like me,
in the Dune
shitposting groups, it's like the Dune fandom seems quite generally the very vocal Dune fandom. I think seems very aware that you know, while they're aware of Frank Herbert's like politics and questionable yeah. like, you know, personal life and how he treated his children, but then also love Dune, but also acknowledge the fact that it's not a good thing. This is not how you should base society on. And it's just so crazy how you've got that, and yet you've got people that collect fucking war dollies going like, "Oh yeah, I think society should totally be based upon the Imperium of Mankind." You're like, are you fucking mental?
I think part of that is actually Frank Herbert's Dune is a nice parallel
yeah.
to this, because one of the things about Frank Herbert's Dune is that on the one hand, Frank Herbert is adamant that Paul Atreides winning is in no way a happy ending.
Yeah.
But the character of Paul Atreides himself is presented as a basically decent guy who always says the right thing and always speaks the truth because he is Frank Herbert's point of view character and Frank Herbert's mouthpiece.
Mm-hmm.
And he just happens to be forced into becoming a genocidal tyrant.
Yeah.
Not his fault he's a genocidal tyrant. It's destiny. He just does the best out of it. So on the one hand, it's a bad idea. But on the other hand, he is actually the hero of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really difficult line to cross. It's a really difficult needle to thread. And he doesn't do it, especially once you get to the sequel. So like in Jew Messiah, there is a bit where Paul Atreides, who is, you know, the despotic emperor of the universe, is in a council room, and he gets one of the other main characters comes to him and brings him a deposition from the Spacing Guild and the Bene Gesserit, basically saying we need a Bill of Rights and a constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically says constitutions is tyranny. Constitutions are tyrannical because they remove people's chance to actually govern themselves. And single person despotism is better because I can't be everywhere or govern everything.
Which and is I the 40k have... universe.
Right. But also, this is also the needle that the 40k universe often tries to thread and often kind of accidentally fails to do, right? In that, on the one hand, and I mean, we had this conversation last time we spoke.
Yeah.
On the one hand, the Imperium of Man is a hell space.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we are constantly presented by heroic individuals who uphold it.
Yeah.
Who are doing this because, so, you know, and, you know, you got to go, no, they're not the good guys. They're the space Nazis, but they're not. There is a level of nuance that is, the problem is that this level of nuance is good.
Yeah.
And I would rather it was there than it wasn't.
I think if it wasn't there, I think you'd be in Star Wars territory.
Yeah. Where, yeah.
Where, you know, depending, because Star Wars can, I think you can look at it. I think Star Wars, there is good Star Wars. There are Star Wars Rebels. Brilliant. And then there is bad Star Wars, generally the films.
Apart from because, the first one and a half.
Yeah. Because I don't know, I think it's because, you know, they tried to present and they've tried to, and obviously there was backlash against it, like going, oh, the Jedi are perfect and do all the stuff. It's like, they're not fucking perfect. They ruined Anakin's life.
Yeah, the problem is that the more that they actually filled in the backstory for things like the Jedi Knights,
yeah,
the more space they included to fuck things up.
Yeah.
Basically, the more that you fill in lore that doesn't need to be filled in, the more space there is to ruin it.
Yeah.
So this happened with, for instance, the Aliens movies.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because Alien Covenant and Prometheus are not bad movies. Well, actually, Alien Covenant's terrible, but...
It is shit.
Yeah, Prometheus isn't a bad movie, but these two films do actually work to the detriment of Alien, because in Alien, there's a bunch of stuff that is basically a prompt for your imagining.
Yeah.
For the audience imagining, and no amount of lore will match that.
Yeah.
In the first Star Wars film, and again, I'm old enough to remember when it was just called Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
General Kenobi, you served my father in the Clone Wars.
It's it a does throwaway so much heavy... line. Yeah.
It does so much heavy lifting, like you said. And actually, it's great. Do we need an entire movie and several seasons of cartoons to fill in what happens in the Clone Wars and a cartoon movie?
It's painful. I mean, that's why there's that joy that people go to of like, well, seeming like, you know, the Old Republic period is like this really cool thing because you had Knights of the Old Republic, and it's, while it did lay some backstory, it still gave you the sense of, but you have no fucking idea what the rest of the galaxy is like at that time period. It's just this world to explore.
Well, yeah, and also it's a video game. It doesn't actually like need to give you the history.
It doesn't need no.
One of the good things about Herbert's Dune series is that he expands his universe forwards. He never expands it backwards.
Yeah, yeah.
So he goes, like, the first book, was it? The first book goes forwards about 12 years to the second. And then to the third book, it's 8 years. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth book, it's 3,500 years. And then it's another 1,500 years to the fifth and sixth books, which are basically of a piece, really. One of the reasons that Dune fans really, really don't like the books that are credited to Brian Herbert, but actually really written by Kevin J. Anderson.
Yeah.
Writer of a buttload of expanded universe Star Wars novels as well, is that they go in and they fill in gaps that didn't need to be filled.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't need a trilogy about the Butlerian Jihad, right?
Yeah.
Like, you don't need that. The fact that there's going to be a TV series that's, I think, started to be filmed, which is going to do...
Oh, about the Bene Gesserit.
Yeah, which is going to be about the history of the Bene Gesserit based upon one of the
gajillion
interminable trilogies that Herbert and Anderson perpetrated. 18! 18 books, Chris. Right.
So here's the question then. Should there be a Dune war game? I did see at the club last night they were playing the Dune board. Is it a Dune board game that's a bit like Risk?
There's so many Dune board games.
Yeah, though. I know, right. Should there be a Dune war game? Would that be cool?
Already a role playing game.
Yeah.
Finally.
Maybe
we're not even talking about the one from 1999 that got...
No, we're talking about the...
And is worth hundreds of pounds if you own a copy.
Modiphius one. But you could do... I was like thinking a Dune war game based upon the... Or even like on the comic book series you were saying.
The Dune war game.
But colourful.
A colourful Dune... Yeah, Denis Villeneuve will not... Yeah, that's not going to happen. Because everything's going to have the film aesthetics, but
everything's grey. Fuck that.
It's all beige. But no, a Dune war game based on the period between the first two books.
Yeah.
Where essentially you could go to other planets and you could essentially invite players to make up their own houses, minor and things, and you could, you know, you've got your Imperial Fremen, you've got your Sardaukar remnants, you've got some like Harkonnen holdouts, you've got some Atreides, you've got pirates, you've got smugglers.
Yeah.
There's a Dune miniatures game would actually be quite fun. Also, wouldn't you want to build a 28mm scale Ornithopter model?
Yeah, I've built the Lego one.
You've got
Yeah, like a 28mm war game would be pretty wicked.
Okay, how much time have you spent holding up the Lego one and just like pressing the
buttons? Every so often. Every so often.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's great.
5 minutes a day, right? Just for the dopamine.
Like, it helps my RSI. No, it doesn't help. But yeah, I think a Dune war game be interesting. I mean, fuck, there's Shatterpoint for Star Wars, and I think Star Wars. I always feel like Star Wars is a bit of a weird one for war gaming because there's like you're basically either Imperial or Rebels or maybe you're you know, smugglers and so forth. But yeah, I think Dune as a war game would be pretty interesting. I mean, it'd be interesting what vehicle, like if they could somehow like squeeze in like interesting vehicle designs as well to expand the kind of like what you could buy. And that's been done before because, you know, we did have the Dune computer games, the RTS.
You could buy the soundtracks to those.
Yeah. So yeah, Dune war game would be pretty cool. I mean, putting this out here, I'd also think just purely as a small Necromundus kind of style skirmish game would be pretty sweet.
That's cool. I'm really looking forward to Trench Crusade because it's a small Necromundus style skirmish
game. I say that because at one point when I was working on Noble Armada for FASA, so Noble Armada is the space combat game for Fading Suns, and Fading Suns is basically Dune. sort of.
I mean, I've actually contributed to one Fading Suns supplement, and
yeah.
Fading Suns so is quite uni.
When I was working on that, I was trying to pitch a Fading Suns skirmish game, like with, you know, minis, and, you know, they'd have personal shields, and, you know, you'd want to show the difference between why, you know, you'd have to have combined arms, because it's like playing Adeptus Titanicus. Like, you can't get, some shit can't get through shields, other shit can. That would be really fun, but yeah. Let's wrap up and talk about Trench Crusade, because I haven't touched it and I want to hear what your thoughts are about it.
Okay, so it's made by Thomas, who made Mordheim.
Yep, interviewed him, great guy.
And Sean, yeah, he's really active in the Facebook community. He's really positive about stuff. I've had a couple of good interactions. He follows my Instagram, which is wild. But yeah, he's really interested in the community. He really likes the converting side of things. He's made a big deal about how there's a second Kickstarter for official Trench Crusade miniatures.
Right, okay.
The first Trench Crusade Kickstarter happened in 2022.
Yeah.
I backed it, in fact.
Same, I've got whichever dude with rifle coming.
Yeah. As I understand it, a combination of manufacturing problems and personal tragedies,
yeah,
which are kind of outside of the of the control of the third person behind it, James Sheriff, had meant that they still haven't managed to get the miniatures to people. But they did a wonderful thing where they gave everybody the STLs for them. So,
oh, that's cool.
So I've got the STLs. So it's like I could have the miniatures if I went to my mate with the 3D printer and said, "Here, Ruth, can you print these out?"
Yeah.
So they'll probably be nicer than the Seercast ones that are coming out. Mm. I'm not sure how I feel about Seercast, but anyway, it's really horrible to get mold lines off of because it's quite soft.
Oh yeah, it's a bit like the Restic stuff that Privateer Press used.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's slightly harder than the white plastic that Reaper used to use for Reaper Bones.
Okay.
It's a lot harder than that, but it's not as hard as polystyrene.
Yeah.
But yeah. So yeah, Trench Crusade, it's a skirmish game. It's set in an alternative history where essentially the Crusades never ended because someone opened a gate to hell.
Like you do.
And we're now in a stage where we're at a technology level of World War One, and it's in 1914 and stuff.
Okay, cool.
So you've got Weird War One style people, but also like crazy blood-soaked nuns and demons,
yeah,
and things. Yeah. There are... How many factions? There are the Trench Pilgrims, who are a bunch of crazy grimdark fanatics. There's New Antioch, which is the basic human force, which is basically like the army, mm-hmm, with a Catholic bent, but more military, as opposed to the Trench Pilgrims, who are more Catholic than military, if that makes sense. So they're both on roughly the same side, but yeah, one side is more Catholic than military, and one side's more military than Catholic. And then on the other side, you've got the heretics, who are all pretty gnarly and messed up, and also the Black Grail, which is basically just demons. And
cool,
they really encourage, conversions and things.
Yeah.
In fact, recently they had a conversion competition on the Facebook page where people were invited to post their conversions, and Mike Francina would send them an original piece of art if they won.
Nice.
Which was very nice. And they were so impressed. Thomas picked more. Is it Thomas? It's spelled
Tomas.
Tomas. Tomas Spence picked more picked more winners than he originally intended to. So more things were drawn, because I think he's made this big deal about how like there are going to be official models for everything,
yeah,
in the game, but you are encouraged to buy proxies and convert your own. Okay, cool. No tournament will bar people based upon you not having the right models.
Yeah, I need to get my head into like the factions and then figure out even what base models are available would be to like start converting from.
I've leaned quite heavily on some of the Allstein and Penitent Crusade models from Bestiarum.
Okay.
A lot of those work for several factions, and they've got the Bestiarum models include a faction of models that basically look like World War One guys. Only their gas masks look like skulls, basically.
Okay, I'll have to have a look at those. That's cool.
Yeah, which, that's kind of the thing. So I'm really looking forward to it. Tormas, I've not got my head round the rules, but I'm given to understand from all the people who've been posting about playtesting it that it is a straightforward and enjoyable game.
I think from the look of it, isn't it like it's a two dice plus stat versus target number, I think?
Yes, it's got an interesting mechanic where penalties are basically done by negative and positive dice.
Right.
So the idea is that if you have a penalty, you add a die to the dice pool, then you pick the two worst dice.
Yeah.
And if you've got a bonus, you add a die to the dice pool and
pick the highest.
Pick the two best dice.
Yeah.
And the bonuses and penalties stack. So you work out, basically, if you've got three penalties and four bonuses, then you'll have one bonus.
Yeah.
And if you've got four penalties, you have one minus. So it's quite nice, and it also means that you don't need to keep track of plus ones and things like that.
Exactly. I mean, this is the joy of, like, I always go back to the fact that, like, with War Machine, I always like the fact that, yeah, it had plus ones and minus ones, but it was still effectively two, if not three dice pool. Bell curves are good. It's why Modern Age is a nice system, because again, it's bell curves and dice.
Yeah, it's essentially it's the tolerable D&D 3.5 fork.
Well, yeah, it's because you don't need, because this is the thing, like, you don't need to work out, like, oh, is rolling 2d4 better than rolling a single d6? Some people don't like mathing that much. Like, I'm cool doing that. Other people don't enjoy it because they can't work out the averages quickly.
Yes, it is.
So, yeah, it is. yeah, but it's just like, it's not. But yeah, I need to look into it. It'd be cool to start, get some ideas of what to build, like where to get some base models for it. Because the thing is, I've got a shit ton of weird shit left over from my Kingdom Death stuff, from
and
the
some of that
screws.
Would actually fit Trench Crusade stuff. I mean, if you've got a pile of Kingdom Death stuff, you've probably got several Black Rail Warbands.
Yeah, exactly.
You're fine. So Trench Crusade interests me because I quite like the whole Weird War One aesthetic. I quite like Grimdark stuff.
Yeah,
I quite like converting things.
Yeah, I see it as more of it's an excuse to get into properly like converting stuff a lot, because I generally seem to paint a lot of stuff and leave it built as is, mainly because I don't know, just because I'm trying to do certain paint job or represent something from the role play game. And then the other thing, I mean, it'll be interesting. Yeah, I'll read the rules. It'd be good to, like, do another episode and talk about get into the rules and our opinions on it. Because I played my first game of what's it called? Kill Team. Kill Team.
I thought you'd been playing that for ages.
I quite like it because the rules for cover and line of sight are janky because in how they're written. It's a very stupid way of how to write, can you see this person through a window or not? But combat's really cool. I like how close combat works, where you roll your dice, your opponent rolls your dice, and then depending upon who's the attacker, who's the defender, you trade, you're basically trading your successes. So you go, if you're the attacker, do you want to use your first successful die to do an attack, or do you use it to parry one of your opponent's dice? And that way of working things, you have to figure out, it's like, is your fighter better at doing damage, or are they better at like defending on this one until someone else can go in? So it's quite cool. I do like it. And it reminded me, and this is the other thing which I'm excited about, is the fact that Monolith have bought all the IP from that used to be Rackham stuff. So Confrontation, Ragnarok and Hybrid. And I've still got Confrontation models, and I've still got Confrontation 3rd Edition rulebook, and I want to basically try that again.
I have hundreds of unpainted Confrontation models. Actually, tell you what.
An AT-43.
I've also got an entire unit of half-painted Griffin Fusiliers.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I've got some of those.
Would totally fit Trench Crusade.
Yeah, you're right. They would do. Actually, the entire Griffin army would fit Trench Crusade.
I've got a pile of Griffins.
The, what were they called? Templars of Hod that came in Hybrid.
I have the Templars of Hod.
There's a solid demonic bad guys as well.
They are, in fact, actually the Scorpions of Durs, one of my favorite models is my Sassius Samaris.
Yes, I've got that one. Yeah.
I've got the first version.
Oh, I've got the second version.
Better than the second version. But
I've got the plastic, the only plastic kit they did before they did the pre-painted plastics, which were all shit. I've got the plastic aberrant and built that.
Oh my god, that's a great kit.
Do you know what's weird about that? I will tell you, and this will wrap up. I'm sure we'll wrap up, and we've got plenty of content for the next time.
Yeah.
Ideas for the next time. Right. Here's the thing that was completely bonkers about Rackham. Right. First of all, Hybrid, brilliant game. If you play with the retranslation of the rules, it makes more sense. As always, overly designed. You had playing cards that had literally squeezed on like two or three paragraphs of flavor text and then a tiny bit of rules.
Oh, so I know. I've seen them. Yeah, it's like wild.
And then, but the aberrant, right? So I would say Hybrid is a perfect thing. If they did that as a Kickstarter, easy. Hybrid. Not Hybrid, the aberrant plastic model they brought out. This is where it gets mental. Plastic pieces, hard plastic, they were pre-clipped out for you and in a vacuum molded container. So each piece sat in a particular spot and the entire plastic they sat in was felted.
It's like
why do you do this?
And people wonder why they went out of business. It's like, right. It's wonderful, it's beautiful, but how many people bought an aberrant kit?
Yeah.
And how many people actually sort of like built it? Like, and also, they also, whatever you may think of Games Workshop retiring armies, inventory is something that you have to clear out.
Yeah.
Right? You do actually have to refresh your inventory. And Rackham, over 8 years, kept the inventory for like something like 16 factions.
Yeah, it was it's huge. Yeah,
and I mean, and again, the translations also. I knew I had some interactions with a guy called Eric Harlow, who was one of the translators for the role playing game that they did.
Right, for Cadwallon.
The English translation of it is unplayable.
I've tried reading it.
And it turns out that part of that is because the two translators weren't given the time to talk to each other.
Oh, no.
And didn't actually have anything to do with it. They just translated it and then like they just put it together without checking it because they didn't give them the time to, which means that there are some things in the first half of the book that are translated one way.
Right.
And they're translated differently in other parts of the book. But worse, there are other stats and characteristics that are translated using the same words that different stats are in the first half of the book.
Wow.
It is literally unplayable unless you actually go back and work out which things are actually sharing words and which things are
the
same
thing. That's
crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
On that note, we're going to wrap up because we've got tons of topics. So our topic for definitely next one is Trench Crusade. I'm going to make effort to read that.
Things
to plug is, like I said, Vow of Absolution is out from Cubicle 7. Please buy it. It's awesome. Buy Inheritance of Embers. That's the Eldari players book also that came out a few weeks ago. That's also awesome that I worked on.
Cool.
You can play Eldari of all types. You can play full Drakari. It's great. That's a game to play. I might have to do that for the stream.
That's basically the equivalent of playing a Sabbath game with Vampire in it.
Yes, yes. And then the other thing is Eldritch Automata is going back to get crowdfunding because it didn't pass on Kickstarter, so they've done some more work. They've done a quick start, and it's going to back a kit. So that's... Eldritch, it's you know, it's Cthulhu, Eldritch, Evangelion, Mecha, but it's not with crappy rule set like Cthulhu, I know. Tech.
Yeah, and also like really, really problematic rapey content.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you've plugged your Patreon, and obviously go over to the Instagram to see cool.
Also, Cthulhu Awakens
stuff. And Cthulhu Awakens from Green Ronin. They're really cool to work with.
Lovely people.
I've bugged them that I'm ready to do. I want to do some more stuff, like because I did enjoy working on the Fantasy Age 2e bestiary. I don't think it's out yet. I think the core book is out finally. It was out like a couple of months ago, so the best route somewhere. And I'd love to do some Modern Age at some point. I haven't worked out what, but I'd like to do something.
I think they've had a reshuffle recently of their developers. Malcolm is not on Cthulhu Awakens anymore. He's moved to Fantasy Age, and Ian Lemke, who many, many years ago was the Changeling, the Dreaming developer for White Wolf, is now responsible for Cthulhu Awakens.
Right, it's such a small world, isn't it? It becomes like Hal worked on Unhallowed Metropolis,
right?
I believe back in the day, I think he was producing it or something. I can't remember the full details. He just said he was glad that I like it, and I was like, yeah, I love it.
What world we're in? Okay,
yeah.
Well, we'll knock it on the head now. So.
It's
always a pleasure to talk, Chris.
It's always fun. That was really good. I'm sure people will get some content, get some interesting opinions of it. Obviously, follow Darker Days Radio. All the links are going to be in this episode.
I can't be bothered to
rattle it off. And obviously, just play a Toy Soldiers. Don't worry. There is no politics in 40K. It's all a satire because it was basically hippies taking the piss out of Thatcherite Britain at the time. So, you know.
It was metalers taking the piss out of Thatcherite Britain.
Yeah.
Like, it was Motorhead fans.
It's punk. It is at its heart still kind of punky, and by doing stuff like having female custodies in there, and I'm sure other
who
things.
Who freaking cares?
It's punk. It's toy soldiers. Be punk with them.
Play with your war dollies. Like them. Don't get upset because bad people buy them as well. Because if you got upset because bad people bought the things you liked, you'd never be able to buy anything.
Well, yeah, we wouldn't play Vampire the Masquerade if that was the case.
Okay.
And on that point,
we'll say goodbye.
And goodbye. Thank you, Sean. And goodbye.
Bye.